Good morning, and welcome to the January 21st, 2021 meeting of the Education Finance Committee of the Minnesota House of Representatives. This meeting, remote hearings like this are held in accordance to House Rule 10.01. The rule has been posted online and is linked in our public meeting notice on the House website. All remote hearings will be recorded and live streamed by House Public Information. Members have the contents of their packets available to them, and for the public, these same meeting materials have been posted online. Members, if you're looking for all these items in one place, they are attached in the calendar event that you received from Ms. Burt earlier today. To get on the list to be recognized by the chair, members using the Zoom interface have the ability to raise their hand via the app. Ms. Burt will place your name on the list to be recognized. If a member is on the phone and doesn't have access to the raise your hand feature, please email Ms. Burt and she will put your question in the queue. This is the digital equivalent of getting the attention of the chair or the committee administrator. An email from your House account with the subject line, please recognize, is all that is required if you're asking for attention. Recognition, from your phone. Ms. Sunderland, would you please call the roll?
Chair Dabney.
Present.
Vice Chair Sandsted.
Present.
Representative Kreisha.
Present.
Representative Bennett.
Present.
Representative Daniels.
Present.
Representative Damuth.
Present.
Representative Drazkowski.
Present.
Representative Erickson.
Present.
Representative Feist.
Sorry, present.
Representative Jordan.
Present.
Representative Marquardt.
Present.
Representative Mueller.
Present.
Representative Richardson.
Present.
Representative Thompson. Excuse me, Representative Thompson.
Present. Thompson, present.
Perfect. Representative Wolgamott.
Present.
Representative Zhang.
Present.
Representative Joachim.
Present.
That is the roll, and we do have a quorum.
Thank you very much, Ms. Sunderland. Representative Sandsted, have you had a chance to review the minutes from yesterday, our January 20th, 2021 meeting?
I have, Mr. Chair, and I will still move those minutes.
Thank you very much. Are there any objections to moving the minutes from Wednesday, January 20th? Hearing none, all those in favor of approving the minutes from that date, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Sandsted. Today, we will be concluding with our overview presentations from state agencies, and we'll be hearing from the Minnesota Department of Education Finance team about COVID relief federal funding allocations to Minnesota. Please, members, feel free to ask questions once the agency has concluded their presentation. I will hand it over to the experts. Whoever would like to start, please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony. Thank you for coming to the committee today.
Good morning, Chair Dabney and members. My name is Denise Anderson, and I am the Chief Financial Officer at the Department of Education. And first of all, I would like to say thank you for inviting us here today to provide you with an update on the federal funds. We're excited to be here today. So today we're going to walk through quite a bit of detail around the federal funding. First of all, in the round one funds, those were the funds that were passed last March 2020. We'll provide you an update on the spending and timelines. And then for round two, some detail about the uses of the funds, allocations and timelines related to round two as well. Before I turn it over to Andre Prahl, our financial director, to present the details to you, I wanted to just provide you with a quick note and let you know that the schools have been working really hard to fully utilize the funding that they are receiving. As you'll see in the next couple of slides, that all but $17,000 of the $244.8 million of the CRF funding was spent. These funds initially had a spending, had a date of December 30th of 2020 in order to have those funds spent. So they did a great job making sure they utilized that funding. Because of that and the tight time frame for using the CRF funds, some of the spending in the other areas in the GEAR and ESSER areas may be less than what you were anticipating. Those funds from round one are available for the state to use, that the schools to use until September 30th of 2022. So they have some time to make sure that they fully utilize the funding that they're getting. So with that, I would like to turn it over to Andre Prahl. And thank you very much for having us here today.
Thank you for coming, Ms. Anderson. Ms. Prahl, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Chair Dabney. My name is Andre Prahl, and I'm the Agency Finance Director at the Minnesota Department of Education. Thank you for having us. Like Denise said, I'm going to provide an overview of how the round one, we're calling them round one or ESSER one funds have been spent and GEAR funds have been spent, and then I'll go into the allocations of the round two or the ESSER and GEAR two funds and how they and our plans for those as we know them at this point. So this first slide is showing you all of the allocations that the Minnesota Department or Minnesota that came to Minnesota this year. So Denise was talking a little bit about the CRF funds. Those were the funds that came to, they came to the state, but the governor's office distributed. This was a grant that the Department of Education worked in conjunction with the Department of Health with to apply to the state, get those funds to the schools to support operational activities such as cleaning supplies, PPE, anything that was related to getting our children back into the schools. So as Denise said, this money was spent. We've also got the Governor's Emergency Relief Fund, GEAR money. Last time around, Minnesota received $38 million of that. Elementary and secondary ESSER money, we received $140 million. We also received some other grants. There were child grants to states that kind of came in at the last minute. We weren't really expecting them. The $160 million for child nutrition grants. Library grants was $509,000. And then although this money doesn't come directly to us, it goes to the Head Start entities. Head Start did receive over $10 million. In terms of the coronavirus relief funds, CRF, this $244 million was for, like I mentioned, operational costs, cleaning, PPE, transportation costs. It also was meant to support student, family, and educator needs. So in this area, there were things like tutoring, school-age care for essential workers, professional development, digital navigators, and they could also use these funds for technology. This slide shows an update of where we are, and as Denise mentioned, we did have $244.5 million that went to the schools. All but $17,000 of that was spent and accounted for and reported to the feds, so we're done managing that. $90 million of it was spent on operational costs. A little over $11 million, was on school-aged care costs. And then $142, the majority of it was spent on family, student family support staff needs. We did have $300,000 for administration. We used that for administering the grants. There, we have some the application costs. And also there were some contracts out for some digital navigator work to help the schools. So this slide shows the GEAR and ESSER money that came to Minnesota. As you probably recall, the GEAR money was, that's a governor's pot, but we worked with them to determine that the first need was gonna be technology, use was gonna be technology, the second use was gonna be summer school, and then we also had $5 million for wraparound services to the 0 to 8 age group. The ESSER money, we had $140 million, and if you will remember, 90% of that money was the allocation of which was prescribed in law. And Department of Education or none of the states had any control over how that money went out. It went out based on the title allocations that those the schools received for that school year. So based on what they received in title, we use the same allocation to get this 90% out to the schools. There was a 9.5% that we had more discretion over. We first allocated those funds to the schools that didn't get title money. And then after that, we allocated it to supplement the GEAR priorities like mental health supports and the historically underserved populations. So here's an update on our GEAR money. Like I mentioned, all of the GEAR money is out. So the schools know their allocations. The process is for them to fill out an application to tell us how they're going to spend it. We approve those, make sure they're eligible uses, and then they can start submitting reimbursement requests for those funds. The schools have spent approximately 11% of their GEAR funds. And then I know everybody's interested in this, and unfortunately I can't give a really good answer, but we won't have exact details on how they officially spent the money until the end of the year when they report to UFARS. But what I can tell you is that the schools who had their budgets approved have chosen to spend their money in these categories. So the first one is mental health supports. They've chosen $64 million. Summer school is about $1 million. Technology is $13.7 million. And then other activities, which might be transportation or childcare services for emergency, is $432,000. Again, Denise pointed out in the beginning of the presentation that this is lower than some might expect to see. But again, they were really focusing their efforts on spending down that $244 million that had to be spent by the end of December. Then there was the grants for $5 million for other entities. That's how it was described in law. They've spent 13% of it, but the contracts went out a little bit later. That's because these were awarded in two different grant opportunities. Half of that was awarded to the regional entities outstate so that they could work with the entities in their areas to get grants out. And then half was a competitive grant program within our area. So those grants, they haven't had a lot of time to spend on those yet. The last $3 million we held back from our original allocation because we were anticipating unanticipated technology needs for the schools. So we're still figuring that piece out. In terms of the ESSER I funds, again, all these funds are out to the schools. The schools who have applied to spend their funds, meaning they've had their budgeted submitted and approved, of that 9.5%, 1.275 million is budgeted to be spent on mental health, 386 on summer programming, 1.12 on technology, and 2.76 on other activities. In the ESSER 90%, so again, this is the portion of the money that the Department of Education has no control over, either the allocation or the spending of it. The mental health was 4.1 million, summer school programming was 487 million, and technology was 22. And if I move this, sorry, I can't see the bottom number on there. Let me open up another slide on my side. Well,
it's 31.9.
Thank you. Sorry about that. I can't figure out how to move the little pictures on the bottom. Yep. Next slide. And then there's these child nutrition grants to states. So the federal government gave us the authority to reimburse schools at the summer school rate, which is higher than the regular school rate. And they also were allowing us to reimburse the schools for all meals, not just the free and reduced priced eligible meals. So that $160 million was to help us cover those costs. All of those funds were spent by October 27th. Meaning they were out the door and accounted for, but they were for meals that were provided by the end of September. Then there were library services grants to state. $509,000 was essentially for technology grants. We awarded 7 grants for the purpose of expanding internet. I know they purchased hotspots in some areas where they didn't have broadband or access to the internet. They went to the public libraries. It couldn't go directly to the schools. By law, it has to go to the libraries, but the libraries could work in conjunction with the schools. To date, $223,000 has been spent. Again, contracts went out late. It was a process to get the contracts out. But these grants, they have through September 30th of 21, which is a year less than the ESSER and GEAR money, which is September 30th of 22. Then the Head Start and Early Head Start grants, again, these didn't come to the Department of Education, but that $10.39 million was awarded to 45 Head Start entities across the state. I don't have an update from them on how much has actually been spent, but I know it's all been awarded. So again, I've kind of touched on these. The ESSER and Gear 1 funds can be drawn back to March 13th and can be spent through September 30th of 2022. And applications, we need to remind schools about this, must be completed by May 1st of 2021. So remember I was talking about the budgeted expenditures, how the schools chose to budget their money. That has, they have to have that application in by the May 1st of 21. And then the ESSER 2 funds can be spent through September 30th of 2023. So here's round two, or ESSER II, Gear II money. We did get our allocations. ESSER II, we received $588 million. The gear relief money was $61 million. And this slide shows the allocations of use. So this time around, the government decided that of that gear money, they wanted to allocate some to the non-public schools. So more than half, $41.69 million, is going to non-public schools. $19 million is for public schools, and then $209,000 is for the administration of those grants. Now, this is the GEAR grant, so that $209,000 is for administration of the non-public school grants. And the eligible uses for these funds are the same as they were for GEAR 1. It's emergency support to LEAs, institutes of higher education, and those other educational entities, related entities. So I thought I would give a few slides or present a few slides on non-public schools' roles and responsibilities, because this is a new function. It's a new piece in the bill. In the past, when these funds were out, the LEAs were responsible for or acquiring items or using the funds for the non-public schools, because the state can't give the non-public schools any money. So we have to sort of shepherd that process and make sure that they get what they need through that. So the LEAs already have that structure in place, and that's how they got the ESSER and Gear 1 money out. However, this time they're requiring that the SEAs do it. So MDE is trying to figure out how that's going to actually work. But our responsibility, according to law, is to provide those services or assistance to the non-public schools. And they say that rather than give money, because obviously we can't give them money directly. We have to provide an application to the schools within 30 days of receipt of that money, and then we have to review their application and either approve or deny it within 15 days. We also have to prioritize the funding that we give to the schools based on enrollment of low-income students and those who are most impacted by the emergency. The non-public school's responsibility is to, once we make that application available, it's to submit that application to us in the time frame that's provided. They have to let us know their number or percent of low-income families that are enrolled in the 19-20 school year. They have to describe what emergency services that they're requesting that we provide to them. And the last one is they have to basically guarantee that they're not going to apply for one of those PPE grants after December 27th. They can have either or, that or these funds. So here's the uses for the non-public schools. They're pretty much the same, worded slightly differently, but pretty much the same as the ESSER or as the GEAR to the public schools. It's to sanitize, disinfect, and clean the schools. It's for PPE. It's improving the ventilation systems, training and professional development, physical barriers to facilitate social distancing, supplies and equipment for public health protocols, expanding capacity to respond to the coronavirus testing. So that could be nurses, that could be the little thermometers to take temperatures, educational technology in the digital environment, redeveloping instructional plans, leasing sites or spaces, again, for social distancing, reasonable transportation costs, again, to accommodate fewer students on a bus, initiating and maintaining educational and support services to assist remote learning. And then the last one is just reimbursing pretty much anything that the school feels is needed related to the coronavirus. ESSER II allocations to the state, so 90% of the allocation is to go to the schools who receive title allocations in an allocation method that's prescribed in law. So they essentially tell us how to do it. So we allocate 90% of that, which is $529,000, and that'll go to all the LEAs who receive Title I allocations. Now, there are some schools and charter schools and co-ops, intermediates, that do not receive Title I allocations, and so they will not be included in that 90%. This 9.5%, we have a little more flexibility over. These are the ESSER grants. We receive $55.8 million there, and then there's an amount for administration as well. So I have this slide up here. I'm not going to go through it, though, a lot, but just to point out that the ESSER 1, the ESSER 2 uses are pretty much the same as the ESSER 1 uses. So you saw this slide before. It's PPE, operational costs, equipment, things like that. So it's the same. And then they've added 3 on the next slide. I'll show you those. So they did add 3 new eligible uses. Most of these would have been considered eligible uses under ESSER 1 anyway, but they called them out separately in the law. So the first one, which is new, addressing academic support among students. So this includes us figuring out how to reliably assess learning loss in the schools. And then there's a requirement in there for the state to show the federal government how we've been using these funds to measure and address learning loss. They also called out school facility repairs and improvements and inspection testing like HVAC systems or air purifying systems, those kinds of things. And that's it. Do you have any questions?
I imagine we will. Thank you very much. Give me just a moment to switch between apps here. Representative Erickson, you have a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you to both of the presenters. This is very informative. A lot of my questions have been answered because I was concerned about the reporting through the UFARs. I guess my question would be, you said that happens later, and I think you said that's because of budgeting. But I'm just wondering, do districts and charters sit on dollars that they could use, and maybe you can't answer that today. You could always email me that answer. But my most important question is in regard to that last slide that you showed for eligible uses under ESSA 2 about access to students' academic process, which is really, really important. I'm just wondering is there a deadline as to when we'll know those results so that districts and charters know how to proceed with learning recovery?
Ms. Prawl.
Chair Dabney, I don't have the answer to that question. We haven't looked into that yet. I don't know, Adosh or Denise, do you have any comments on that?
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Rooney, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed.
Mr. Chair, committee members, my name is Adosh Rooney. I'm the Director of Government Relations at the Department of Education. Representative Erickson, just to echo Ms. Prawl's comments, that's information on the timeline. We'll be getting more direction from the federal government as we go on here and be able to round out how we translate it into state guidance for districts and charters. But as with all the updates from the federal government, we'll be sure to update the legislature when we hear a little bit more, and we'll put a particular bell on that piece to make sure that we get that to you when we know.
Thank you, Mr. Uni. Representative Erickson, further questions?
Chair. Yes, this is for Mr. Uni as well. So are the parameters that you're referring to coming under the Trump administration or now under the Biden administration as far as the Department of Education? Were those parameters in place previously, or will these be new from, it's going to be Secretary Cardona?
Ms. Prawl? The Biden administration has had, 23 hours almost. have they gotten information to you yet?
No, that bill was put out under, Chair Downey, so, mm-hmm. Yes, that bill was put out under the Trump administration.
Yes.
We received no guidance from the U.S. Department of Education that anything has changed yet.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Certainly, Representative. Representative Feist.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a few questions related to the slide that broke down the funding received between public and non-public schools. And these might be somewhat basic questions because I'm new to this committee, but I figured that if I had them, the general public might also have them, so they were worth asking. So I can ask all three, they're kind of related and they're all short. So the first question is, was the breakdown between the funding allocation between non-public and public schools the same across all states? Was that a percentage that was the same everywhere? My second question is, I'm curious what the percentage breakdown is in Minnesota in terms of how many public versus non-public schools we have. And lastly, I'm curious if we know what the relative financial health was of non-public versus public schools in terms of need as we addressed COVID in the most strategic way. And those are my questions. Thank you.
Ms. Prawl?
Thank you, Chair Dabney. I will attempt to answer these questions. So yes, the allocation to the non-public schools was written in law and it was the same for every state. So they gave us our portion for the state of Minnesota, which was $41.697 million. So yep, that was prescribed. We didn't have control over it. In terms of the number of public schools, non-public schools, we have about 450 non-public schools, which is more than I thought when we were looking through this. And I think the public schools, oh geez, Denise, is it 500 and I'm going to add these up really quick unless somebody can. I think it's like 500. And, let me see. Sorry about that.
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Rooney?
Yep.
Ados Rooney, Department of Education. I can provide a little bit of an assist here. It's the last I checked, it was around 536 combined between charter schools and district schools and districts.
Thank you.
Thank you. And then your last question, I was going to ask if you could repeat that so I could understand a little more clearly what you're looking for.
Yeah. Representative Feist?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. My last question was, do we know, generally speaking, what the financial health of the public versus non-public schools are in terms of the level of need in terms of addressing COVID?
Ms. Prawl?
Chair Dabney, no. We don't have that information. I know that what we're required to do according to law is put out an application that asks for data back from the schools to talk about their need, how they plan on spending, what their need is and how they want to spend the money and their level of low income students. And we will have to base our allocation on that. But I see Denise Anderson, did you want to add anything to that?
Ms. Anderson?
Chair Dabney members, I just wanted to add that non-public schools are not required to report data to the Department of Education, so we don't have that information on hand, but as Andre mentioned, we'll be putting out a survey as a part of the application process. Thank you.
Mr. Strom, I believe you've provided some runs that may speak to some of the questions that Ms. Feist, or Representative Feist has raised.
Mr. Chair, Representative Feist, there will be some runs in the packet. I'm not sure if this is when you wanted to go to those or not. A couple other little bits of information that may be helpful to you. On the number of schools, often the relevant count we may more look at is the number of pupils served. About 7% of the state's pupils are served in a traditional non-public environment. About 70,000 of the state's school-age children attend traditional non-public schools. So even though the number of institutions, if you were to measure non-public schools and at the district and charter level are relatively the same, the student population is somewhat different. Mr. Chair, you may want to get into this at a different point in time, and the department may wish to speak to this, but on the issue of the allocation for the non-publics, there was a bit of a kerfuffle with the first round in terms of the language that Congress passed and the the way the administration initially interpreted what Congress's intent was. There was some back and forth there and guidance given and then a couple of lawsuits. And the result was a little bit of confusion under the initial allocation under the ESSER I fund. So I think that's the reason why you see a fairly large allocation in the second round of GEARS funding, because of the confusion surrounding the language and the requirements for the distribution when it was part of the ESSER I money.
Thank you for that. Representative Jordan, or does the department wish to comment any further on that, the kerfluffle?
Chair Dabney, only to concur, that's right. Under ESSER, they did that whole equitable share piece. There were a lot of lawsuits and conversation back and forth, so I agree that's probably right.
It was quite the event. Thank you. Representative Jordan, you have a question.
Hey, thank you, Mr. Chair. I think it might be useful for me to listen to Mr. Strom present his half of the hearing before I ask my question.
All right. Mr. Strom, it looks like you're up.
Mr. Chair, members, there's a series of printouts that may provide you some district-by-district information on each of the portions of money that MDE mentioned in their presentations today. I think we'll start with the CRF money from the first round. I think it's really important as we're talking about this to point out the administrative burden that the, in a good way, no doubt, that the administrative burden that's happened to the Department of Education and the work they've needed to do. Essentially, even though these formulas that the governor has put together or this federal law required are like aid payment style formulas, these really are all operating as grant programs. So there's requirements for districts to apply, there's reallocation procedure if districts don't apply and money's left. So there's a whole variety of ways that even though these look like a simple allocation of funds, they put a very significant strain on MDE in terms of the administrative work. At the MDE website, they've got a section devoted to the COVID funding, and they've got some PDFs there that are helpful to folks. And we've reworked those for this committee and put some additional data on them so that there may be some a little more context for members as we examine the funding. So if you'd like to go to the CRF printout first, we'll put that up on the screen and very quickly walk through the columns there. Mr. Chair, members, the printout in front of you shows the funding at the top. There's the state totals for the first round of the or the CRF money from that was the money that had to be used by December 31st. So this is the amounts that MDE was charged with making sure got out the door and spent right away. That first column there shows the pupil count. Even though these things aren't necessarily computed on this basis, it provides a sense of scale for us as we go up and down the list. And then each of our strata that you often see follow the state totals next. And then on this particular printout, the schools are just all listed in alphabetical order for you. As you work across the printout, you can see the total amount of funds, $146.7 million. And those were divided into each of a couple of areas. The operating money was first. You can see the $146.7 million there. Then there was a section called the student support and family portion, which was $39.1 million. And then finally, the third category, which often goes by the acronym HUS. And so you can see the total there of $244.5 million. And then you can look up and down and see how the amounts of each of those categories is distributed on a per pupil basis. Again, not because that's how it was distributed, but just to give you a sense of size so that one could compare Anoka, for example, and Ada Borup and have some sense of whether the numbers were meaningful. And then those last four columns on the right are the same things on those per pupil basis. So if we just follow across on the state average line there, you can see a That $170 in the first category is the same for everyone. You can see the relative amounts in the second column are relatively the same. And then that third column varies from district to district based on those characteristics. And the average then is $283 per pupil in total in this funding. And you can look up and down the list at how that was distributed amongst the districts. As the staff from MDE pointed out to us, these funds essentially had to be spent right away, and the attention was paid on these by districts. As the department mentioned, for bookkeeping purposes, it's going to split between 2 years. Some of these amounts, I believe, were captured in the fiscal year 20 end of year, but most of them will be fiscal 21 expenditures. And so when they're processed through the state accounting system called UFARS, the books will close on June 30th for this school year. And it takes several months into the fall before the district has its audit signed off on, and then that data through the department will become available to us. So sometime, I would guess late next fall, the spending associated with this funding will be available to legislators and others. So, Mr. Chair, members, maybe we should move on then to the spreadsheet titled CARES Act Gears. It's got both of those. It's got both the ESSER-1 funds and the GEAR funds on it. Again, important to mention to members that these act as grants, even though they look like state aid amounts, so there's a fair amount of processing that needs to go into those. The categories that were mentioned with the Department of Education printout, the governor's account called GEAR is that first category of $30.1 million in. You can see that allocation across the districts and the state. On this printout, the districts are sorted in numerical order. And of course, we're happy to share these as worksheets if anyone wants to resort or otherwise look at the data. Then the ESSER funds were divided into the two components, the 90% and the 9.5% grant components. And you can see how those amounts compare for districts, and then the middle column there, the 169.5 on the first round, the sum of these two, you can see how that total is distributed amongst the strata, amongst regions of the state. And then the last four columns show these amounts on an enrollee basis based on the fall 2019 number of students enrolled. Again, not how the money was calculated to be shared, but rather just a way for us to scale units at Aiken and Minneapolis or whichever districts folks want to look at, that there's a metric of measurement between the two that helps compare. So members can go through those printouts, they can look at where they are with their funding and see how they compare to neighboring districts and see how that money's being allocated. Then there's a third category of funding, that's the ESSER $2. This is the recently released information. MDE has as quick as possible gotten these numbers out, and we've reorganized them just a little bit. This is estimated distribution, likely to be distributed the same way as the ESSER-1 funds. Quite a bit more money in total, $529 million for districts. Again, just to display this, the amounts are shown on an enrollee count from fiscal year 19, but you can see how the ESSER-2 money is expected to go out to the school districts and charter schools of the state, $529 million or $594 per student, essentially. So Mr. Chair, that's the ESSER-2 funding. Again, these are sorted in numeric order and members can look up and down the spreadsheet, and remember that the districts tend to be clustered by county and can compare these. And again, we can share spreadsheets if members prefer to sort them in a different order. And then finally, Mr. Chair, there were a series of charter schools and non-public schools who applied for the Payroll Protection Program, which often goes by the acronym PPP. The way that data was released at the time the spreadsheet was put together was in ranges. It was only released by unit for those with more than $150,000 loan. These were released according, and the Small Business Administration, the SBA, released these by essentially the industry codes, and the code 611110 essentially is the one that covers most things we think about as schools. Charter schools, in addition to being eligible for the funding under the ESSER and GEARS money, were also eligible to apply because they're organized as nonprofits for funding under the PPP program. For those that had more than $150,000 loan, the loan amount was reported in bands, in ranges, essentially. And so these are sorted from most to least in those ranges. And you can see, for example, if we look at the first one listed, the Minnesota Transitions Charter School, which is the largest charter school in Minnesota. And you can see that their range for the loan was somewhere between $2 and $5 million. And so the spreadsheet shows what their amount would have been if it was the low end of the range or at the high end of the range. And then the last set of columns is the midpoint. Again, the way the data was reported, there's no way for us to know independently whether they got at the low, the high, or the somewhere in between in the range, but this gives a rough sense of where that is. The NAICS code allows charter schools to be looked at separately than other non-publics. So there's a column on the right that demarks charter schools, and this printout is sorted so that the charter schools show first, and then they're listed just in the relative range of that loan. And then as you go to the next page, the non-publics that applied are listed as well. And here, a student count from the reported students for the last school year was used. The jobs retained number that was a part of the application is put on the sheet if it was reported by the school. And then again, the ranges show up here. So this gives a sense of how the PPP loans worked. As I said, the way the data was released to us, there was only a listing for those with loans of more than $150,000, and it was listed by range. So a school may be toward the low end or the high end of that range. And this is a way for folks to look at the PPP numbers. And as the department mentioned, under this last round now of funding, a significant portion of the GEARS money is for the non-public schools, but that also disqualifies them from the next round of PPP funding. So, Mr. Chair, members, those were the printouts that are in your packet to complement the discussion that the Department of Education provided regarding the uses of the funds and those kinds of things.
Thank you very much, Mr. Strong. Representative Jordan, back to you.
Yes, thank you, Chair Dabney. And I think this is a question for Mr. Strom or maybe someone from the department. Do we have any data or have the charters and I'm very curious about this PPP amount. Has MBE asked charters and private schools how much money they asked for or received? That's definitely a question.
Ms. Prawl, Ms. Anderson?
Chair Dabney, this is Denise Anderson. That was not a program that was managed by the Minnesota Department of Education. It was managed, I believe, through DEED, maybe?
The PPP loan program was run through the Small Business Administration.
So, Mr. Chair.
Representative Jordan.
So MBE has no way of knowing how much money these charters or private schools receive from the federal government or what they spent it on. Presumably it was staffing costs, but we don't have any receipts for that for MBE to analyze.
Mr. Chair?
Mr. Strong?
Mr. Chair, Representative Jordan, charter schools follow the same accounting laws as school districts in Minnesota. So these monies will be identified for the charter schools in Minnesota. Once they are doing their books, there will be one of the categories of the accounting system we refer to UFARS is the source of revenue, and those funds will be identified and will show up on their budgets. So the Department of Education will have a good sense once those are all processed through about how much each charter school got in revenue in that category of funding. On the privates, on the non-public school side, depending on how the non-public school is organized, many are organized as nonprofits, separate nonprofits. And in those cases, their financial bookkeeping, which is not submitted to the state, but is filed for other purposes, will show sources of revenue. So there will be some ways to see that in the future for the non-publics, but for the charters, they're treated just like a school district in terms of their accounting, and they've got to account for that money.
Mr. Strom, the private schools filing that are structured as independent nonprofits, am I remembering correctly that they would file some financial data with the Attorney General's office? And if I'm right on that, is that public data?
Mr. Chair, I'm the wrong one to ask about what's public and what's not, but generally those reports for the nonprofits are filed with the AGs, and those are available for all to see. So if you go to the AG's website, you can look at the forms that nonprofits in Minnesota file. I think one of the accounting issues that may be harder is if there are joint oversight of the schools by another organization, that it may be harder to identify, particularly if the organization got a PPP for a variety of purposes. It may be hard to separate out just the school's portion of that. But I'm getting out of my area of expertise here, so I don't want to steer people wrong.
Thank you, Mr. Strom. Representative Jordan.
Yes, perhaps maybe Mr. Strom, this would be a better question then. So what funds would a charter school use to fund staffing, and how were those funds impacted by the coronavirus?
Mr. Strom?
Mr. Chair, Representative Jordan, the Charter Schools Act, just like districts, essentially, in terms of their spending, their spending is going to be on the same categories of activities as a district. They're going to be spent on staff costs and on maintenance costs, administration costs, all those kinds of things. And as I said, the UFARS system is both the revenue and spending side. So we'll see the revenue coming in on UFARS for each of the charter schools. And then on the spending side, in just the same way that one sees school district spending, one will see the spending that the charter school does by each of the categories.
And then
Representative Jordan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for your indulgence. I'm still trying to figure this out. Did any like traditional public school district receive a PPP loan from the federal government to help with staffing costs?
Mr. Chair,
Mr. Strom,
Representative Jordan, it was not available to a public a traditional municipal style public organization like a school district. Minnesota's charter schools are somewhat unique. They're structured, they're required by law to be structured as non-publics, but the statute also states that they're a public institution, and they are essentially for purposes of open meeting law and financial reporting and all sorts of other reportings, essentially a public thing. But because they're structured as a nonprofit, they were eligible to receive a PPP.
Representative Jordan, any last question?
No, so just so I'm understanding correctly, charter schools were eligible for PPP loans, but a charter school in Minneapolis, in the city of Minneapolis, was eligible for a PPP loan, but Minneapolis Public Schools was not.
Mr. Strom?
Mr. Chair, that's right, yes.
Okay.
Representative Jordan, any closing comment?
No, I find that to be an interesting, and I say that as a Minnesotan, an interesting fact. And I would appreciate more information as to why that is and why this funding stream was, and why these charter schools, which charter schools identify as public schools, why they were eligible for this funding, but Minneapolis Public Schools or any other public school district in the state was not. And I'm hoping that's something we can get more information about in the future. So thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Mr. Strom, for all these great answers.
Representative Kreshaw.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Strom, I appreciate to the testifier and to Mr. Strom having the conversation about the whole field of all the education that we talk about. Could you also make sure that and just let us know how the Native American schools are captured as well? I don't want to leave them out of this conversation. And which side do they fall on this as we look at this?
Mr. Strom, regarding the tribal schools?
Mr. Chair, committee members, there are four tribal contract schools in Minnesota, and probably best for the Department of Education to speak to this, but these four schools are essentially under the Bureau of Indian Education. There are some formulas in our school funding formula. There's a tribal contract aid formula. So there are aid payments to these schools, and there are some state rules that these schools abide and follow. But generally speaking, these four schools are under the BIE. There are, I believe they show up on a couple of these printouts. I'll look through their numbers, by the way, are in the 1000s. So those of you that are quicker getting back to the printout, if you look in the 1000s, you'll see the four tribal contracts. Perhaps MDE could speak to the various ways that the four tribal contract schools were treated under each of these.
Ms. Anderson, is that one for you?
I can answer it, Chair.
Oh, please do.
Okay, so the tribal schools, yes, are treated differently. They receive their funds, their ESSER money from the Bureau of Indian Education directly. So we did not include them in any of that. However, we did include them in the CRF in the same manner that we include with the CRF funds in the same manner we included all the other schools. So the only place they were treated differently was in the ESSER funds that were allocated based on that 90%.
Thank you very much. Representative Kreshaw?
Thank you for that. Just a quick follow-up, but just so we're clear, they do also receive public funds from the state of Minnesota. Is that correct?
Ms. Anderson, do you want to say yes?
Yes.
All right. And we all agree it's a good thing. Thank you, Representative Kreshaw. Representative Marquardt, you have a question.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. I'd like to go back to those district runs on ESSER 1 funding and ESSER 2 funding. And where ESSER 1 funding, it looked like the per student, per pupil funding was almost the same. And yet when you get to the ESSER 2 funding, I was looking at two school districts in the district I represent, they're only 20 miles apart, appear to say have the same demographics and almost the same size, but one's getting about three times more per pupil than the other district. So what is the formula difference between the ESSER 2 funds versus the ESSER 1 funds? What would cause that difference?
Ms. Prawl, Ms. Anderson?
Chair Gavney, I can take that one. The allocation method is exactly the same. So what we did for our ESSER 2 allocation, and by the way, that's preliminary, and although it was presented to you in terms of per pupil amount, the allocation is different. So it was allocated to the schools based on their Title I allocation. So all we did when we took the ESSER 2 allocation, or we came up with that, is we took the new pot of money and applied the exact same criteria to the exact same schools to get those amounts. So I would tell you that it is exactly the same. And that, by the way, that is prescribed in law. MDE has no control over how those funds are allocated or how they're used.
Representative Marquardt?
Well, thank you for that. Thank you, Mr. Chair. If I get asked, and I mean, they're just, it seems like there's, I didn't quite understand how in ESSER 1, they're all, it looked like it was all 170 or whatever it was, and there's quite a change in this one, but it has to do with their Title I funding. I mean, I guess if that would be the key, that so I could have something to say. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Representative Marquardt. Either Ms. Anderson or Ms. Prawl or Mr. Strom, maybe a 2-minute overview of Title I, and just so that members have a little better grounding in what that means and why that might have been a priority for the federal government in the distribution of these funds? Kind of a define our terms moment.
I can speak to that if you'd like.
Please.
Chair. All right.
Thank you, Ms. Prawl.
The Title I allocation, and I did just try to get this in plain language from our title people, so I'm going to read from an email that I just received, but it's based on geographical school district population poverty estimates from the U.S. Census Bureau and are based on a statistical model that incorporates these things. So they look at the Census Bureau, they look at administrative records taken from federal income tax returns, it looks at supplemental nutrition assistance programs, it looks at the most recent census and recent updates to population estimates, data on supplemental security income recipients, and lastly, economic data from the Bureau of Economic Analysis. So I know the formula is complicated, and I tend to usually say it's based on free and reduced price lunch, but it's more than that. It's all these pieces.
So it's you know, as opposed to, for instance, our compensatory education funding that is solely based on free and reduced price lunch numbers, this is a more multi-factor measure of poverty in the geography of the school district.
Correct.
Thank you very much.
Chair Dabney?
Yes, I'm sorry. I
this is Denise.
Oh, yes. Please proceed.
Thank you. I just wanted to clarify also that the data that you have in front of you, the ESSER II is only the 90% portion of the ESSER funds for round two. It doesn't include the additional 9.5% that will be going out in grants. So I wasn't sure if there was an apples to apples comparison there, but I just wanted to make that clear. It's only the 90% portion. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ms. Anderson. Any last questions from members? Seeing none, that puts us at the conclusion of today's meeting. Ms. Anderson, Ms. Prawl, thank you very much for coming in today and presenting on these issues to the committee. Mr. Strom, thank you for the runs and for your presentation as well. Members, we will be meeting all 3 days next week again. I appreciate your time and attention to these issues, and we will see you next week. Enjoy the weekend. Good day.